stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. ISIS claims responsibility for terrorism in Paris. The Islamic State group is claiming responsibility for killing more than 120 people in Paris in a string of shootings and bombings Friday night. French President François Hollande Saturday called the attacks an act of war. Lisa Bryant reports from the French capital.
Police cordoned the area around a popular musical spot called the Bataclan, where dozens of hostages had been held earlier Friday evening and a number had been killed. Ambulances and fire trucks maneuvered around a crowd of journalists and curious bystanders. The Bataclan was one of several spots targeted by gunfire and explosions around the city. The casualties are far higher than January's attacks here in the French capital. Witnesses told the media they had seen two or three individuals enter the Bataclan. The assailants reportedly started firing wildly with automatic rifles. Some witnesses described a bloodbath.
Mes chers compatriotes, au moment où je m'exprime, des attaques terroristes d'une ampleur sans précédent.
In a televised address, French President François Hollande described the attacks as horrific and said the government had mobilized all its forces to neutralize the threats and secure the areas. Besides the Bataclan, there was an explosion near the Stade de France sports stadium and gunfire in several places not far from the Bataclan. Police cars were still racing through the city early Saturday morning. Officers had sealed off new streets, and they told passersby to head on home. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
President Obama said the attacks were an outrageous attempt to terrorize civilians. In Vatican City, Pope Francis expressed his profound distress and said there cannot be justification, religious or human, for such attacks. This is VOA News. World powers in Vienna for talks on Syria's political future are reacting to Friday's terrorist attacks that left scores of people dead or wounded. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius said the attacks show the necessity of coordinating in the fight against terrorism. Secretary of State John Kerry said there was agreement that attacks such as those in Paris and Beirut, as well as events in Iraq, were the most vile, horrendous, outrageous, unacceptable acts on the planet. He said the incidents would stiffen the resolve of world powers to fight back. And those world powers are seeking to narrow their differences today on the country of Syria as they begin a second round of talks establishing the framework for a political resolution to that country's prolonged and costly civil war. The talks in Vienna are expected to focus on identifying Syria's moderate opposition groups. The U.S. and its allies may seek to bridge differences with Russia and Iran over the political future of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Iraqi Kurdish President Masoud Barzani says the Kurdish fighters' liberation of Sinjar will have a positive impact on other jurisdictions controlled by Islamic State in northern Iraq. President Barzani says, without doubt, any victory in any area will have a big impact on achieving victory in remaining areas, and without doubt, the liberation of Sinjar will have a big impact on liberating Mosul. Kurdish soldiers unfurled a large Kurdish flag near Sinjar in celebration of the victory. The man known as Jihadi John, a leading spokesman for the Islamic State, has apparently been killed. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition fighting the Islamic State group said officials believe a drone strike in Syria late Thursday killed Jihadi John, who Western intelligence agencies identify as Mohammed Emwazi. British Prime Minister David Cameron.
This was an act of self-defense. It was the right thing to do. Today I want to thank the United States. The United Kingdom has no better friend or ally. And I want to pay tribute to all those professionals in our own security and intelligence agencies and armed forces for the extraordinary work they do on behalf of our country.
The Kuwait-born Emwazi, a British citizen, has been one of the top targets of Western intelligence agencies since he appeared in videos depicting the beheadings and other killings of Western hostages. Amid threats from Islamic State militants, Turkey is putting unprecedented security measures in place for meetings of G20 heads of state in the coastal city of Antalya tomorrow. The International Association of Athletics Federations is banning Russia from participating in global track and field events because of alleged state-sponsored doping. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
As of today, I'm sending some of my people to Uganda to really help put in place the necessary requirements to start the dialogue.
The African Union wants to begin immediate inclusive talks to end the political crisis in Burundi.
It was a reminder for every other candidate to address himself or the time of closure for the campaign.
The Ugandan Electoral Commission warns political parties to stick to rules about their campaigns ahead of next year's general election.
If everybody in the world thinks it's one thing and they're saying, well, I don't think that's the thing, whatever credibility they have, they're just losing.
And Russia plans to begin banning all Egypt Air flights to Moscow beginning today. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Islamic State militant group has claimed responsibility for simultaneous attacks on six Paris locations late Friday night that killed at least 127 people. Assailants used automatic weapons and detonated suicide vests in the attacks, wounding roughly 200 more. The terrorist group issued a statement Saturday saying the attacks were in response to airstrikes against the so-called Islamic State. It also released an undated video threatening more violence unless France changes its policy. For more on the latest development, VOA's Lisa Brand joins us live via telephone link from the French capital, Paris. Good evening, Lisa.
Good evening.
Lisa, let me ask you, what is the latest development in Paris at the moment?
Well, in terms of what's happening on the streets, people have returned to the streets. It's tense, and I can tell you a little bit more about that later. But in terms of actual news, we have the French president, François Hollande, who has blamed Islamic State for what he calls an act of war after Islamic State, as you noted, had taken responsibility for these attacks, almost simultaneous attacks that took place on Friday evening in different spots around Paris, along with the Stade de France. There are police are everywhere on the streets. You can hear them, their cars. They're still trying to track down, we would guess, probably some suspects who might be linked to the attackers. Seven have blown themselves up. Another apparently was shot by police. And obviously, they're trying to get more information about exactly what happened, who might be linked to the attacks, both here in France and overseas.
Now, Lisa, still talking about how the French citizens or residents of Paris are reacting to this unfortunate event, what is the talk on the street following the implementation or the enforcement of the state of emergency in Paris or France in general?
Yes, I mean, this state of emergency is really something that has not happened in France for decades. But on the streets, although Parisians were told to stay at home, the streets are certainly quieter than they usually are on a Saturday. However, there are a lot of Parisians who are out. I went down to three of the spots where that were hit by the assailants. There was in one, there was a line sort of around the corner of people who were donating blood to the point where then a nurse came out and said, listen, we have enough, please come back later and donate. Others were laying flowers and candles in some of the areas, the Bataclan, the musical spot where so many people were killed. Then also these two, one bar and a restaurant almost facing each other in a small street. They were talking about what was happening. They were saying essentially that they were Some were afraid. Some said they would not be bowed by the terrorist attacks and that they would continue doing what they usually did. And a lot of people just called for solidarity in France.
What has been the response of the authorities following the undated video that IS released threatening more violence unless France changes its policy?
Well, I mean, I think the bottom line is the French government is not going to bow to terrorist demands. I mean, that essentially was the message that was sent by Mr. Hollande this morning. So I would say concretely, France has started to launch airstrikes in September against targets, Islamic State targets in Syria. I would be surprised if it would change that policy because of what happened in Paris and around Paris with the Stade de France Stadium. However, I think Mr. Hollande is talking about, you know, making sure that that those who were responsible for the attacks are tracked down or those who might still be alive and brought to justice, and that France wants to make sure that its citizens are protected to the extent that it can. So there will be, you know, more army on the street. We already have them from the Paris terrorist attacks in January, and the police, as I said, are really out in force these days.
Will you say that the authorities have the situation under control, and are they giving any assurances to Parisians or French citizens or people in the country about protecting them from possible attacks in the future?
Well, I think it's really, I mean, I guess attacks like this one are really, you know, soft targets. I mean, it's very hard to tell people to stay at home and not go out to dinner or not go out dancing and listening to music, as was the case last night. So I think it's impossible to guarantee citizens and residents that they are going to be okay. One thing that I did notice as I was walking around the streets today is that every time there was a congregation of people, either in front of the Bataclan or at the what they call the Place de la République, it's a very iconic square where you saw that huge demonstration in January. Every time people would congregate, the police would come out and tell them to move on. So they're worried about citizens congregating in small groups, I would guess, because that makes them easy targets. So you really had the sense today, I mean, there were roads blockaded, police coming out, driving in, walking out, you know, getting out of their cars with their guns in their hands. So you had the feeling that, you know, to a certain extent, this is a city that's still under siege. But of course, the talk by authorities is we're going to do what we can to protect our citizens.
Thank you very much. VOA's Lisa Bryan joining us live via telephone link from the French capital, Paris.
My pleasure.
The African Union says it wants to begin immediate inclusive talks to end the political crisis in Burundi. At the same time, the East African Standby Force has been called on to prepare in case the situation gets worse. For VOA, Martha van der Wolf reports from the African Union headquarters in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
The Peace and Security Council of the African Union said Friday it will support inclusive talks for the Burundi crisis while preparing the East African Standby Force for a possible intervention. AU Peace and Security Commissioner Ismail Shergri says dialogue can bring Burundi back to normality.
As of today, I'm sending some of my people to Uganda to really help put in place the necessary requirement to start the dialogue. We are in full support of the efforts of President Yoweri Museveni and his team.
The international community has called on Burundi's government and opposition to take part in the proposed talks. Friday, opposition group UPRONA welcomed efforts for dialogue but said it hopes that peacekeepers will be deployed in the near future. The government has so far not committed to any kind of dialogue. Meanwhile, the European Union has announced that non-essential employees and families of staff are being evacuated from Burundi. Commissioner Shergri says that contingency plans are being made to send African troops into Burundi if talks do not stabilize the situation.
The Constitutive Act gives us that opportunity. For the time being, it's a contingency planning. But we have to be prepared and really not allow to have a very sad surprise.
The Burundi crisis started in April when President Pierre Nkurunziza decided to run for a third term in office. Opposition groups claimed it was unconstitutional and boycotted July elections that were won by the sitting president. Violence in the small nation has killed an estimated 240 people and prompted more than 200,000 to flee to neighboring countries. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The Electoral Commission of Uganda has warned political parties and their presidential candidates to stick to rules. In the recently signed Memorandum of Understanding, they are required to end their daily campaigns at 6 p.m. local time or face the consequences. Electoral Commission spokesman Jotham Taremwa told me the electoral body is pleased with the conduct of the campaign so far, but warned that parties and their candidates could face sanctions if they continue to flout stipulations they agreed to abide by.
So far, we are pleased with the progress of the presidential campaign. Apart from receiving some reports that some of the candidates were not sticking to the 6 o'clock time for closing their rally, but we issued a statement, and since then, we haven't gotten reports of that kind. So far, so good.
Was it specifically issued to those who flouted the regulation or issued out to everybody?
No, to everybody, it was a reminder for every other candidate to address himself or herself to the time of closure for the campaign. And we shoot out to all of them, not individual candidates.
Electoral Commission has suspended the nomination process for local government, and some people are displeased. Lord Mayor of Kampala, Erias Lukwago, is not pleased that the Electoral Commission took such action. What prompted the Electoral Commission to suspend the local government nomination process?
Kampala Capital City Authority is governed by the Kampala Capital Authority Act 2010. In that very act, the minister in charge of Kampala is supposed to table the regulations, among which concern the election of the Lord Mayor and the Deputy Lord Mayor. He is supposed to table those ones in Parliament and then send a copy to Electoral Commission on how we should conduct those elections. So as it is now, the regulations have not yet been tabled before Parliament.
Wouldn't this disrupt the timetable of the Electoral Commission on this matter?
When the regulations are tabled, you expect candidates to come as independents, some to come as NRM, some to come as DP, others from other opposition parties. So by postponing the nomination, it does not mean that we are locking out the opposition. We are saying, let us wait for the regulations to be in place, then the nomination process can be open. And then you receive contenders from every other party.
Jotham Taremwa is the spokesman for the Ugandan Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Russia is banning all Egypt Air flights to Moscow as of November 14. The move follows a plane crash 2 weeks ago that killed 224 people returning to Russia from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt's premier Red Sea resort town. Analysts say the tourism industry in Egypt is coming to a halt as some Egyptians call the international reaction to the crash Western terrorism. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more from the capital, Cairo.
At a restaurant in the Cairo suburb, 28-year-old Osama El-Sayed washes vegetables for his customers' breakfast this Saturday. The plane crash was a disaster for Egypt's tourism industry, but he says, like many Egyptians, he feels he is in the dark about the status of the investigation. Britain and Russia say the crash was most likely caused by a bomb on board. Militants claiming links to the Islamic State group say they carried out the attack, but the Egyptian government says the investigation has so far been inconclusive. Britain, Russia, and several other countries have canceled direct flights to Sharm el-Sheikh, and Moscow on Friday banned all Egypt Air flights from landing in Russia. Tourists from Britain and Russia make up the bulk of Sharm el-Sheikh's visitors. Analyst Daniel Wagner, who heads U.S.-based security consulting firm Country Risk Solutions, says Egypt is taking the wrong approach to the investigation.
Well, I don't know. I think they're missing the boat, right? I mean, if everybody in the world thinks it's one thing and they're saying, well, I don't think that's the thing, whatever credibility they have, they're just losing.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi Wednesday visited Sharm el-Sheikh, saying Egypt is safe and urging the international community to inspect the airport. Regardless of what caused the crash, the impact on the tourism industry here has been devastating. Egypt says it stands to lose $280 million a month. On the streets of Cairo, some people are angry. Islam Ryan, a soldier, says Egypt's economy depends on tourism, and the flight cancellations are cruel. Maybe it was a terrorist attack, he says, but that doesn't mean the government isn't capable of securing the airport after the breach. Local newspaper Watan said tourism in Sharm will survive the crash. This paper described the flight cancellations as another form of attack, calling them Western terrorism. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
A modern bus rapid transit project is about to be launched in the Tanzanian commercial capital Dar es Salaam. The project, expected to be operational next month, is the only one in East and Central Africa and is meant to ease transport woes in the city that lacks mass transportation. Chabi Barasa is a journalist with the Tanzanian newspaper The Daily News. Reporter Douglas Impuga reached him to find out about the project.
Yeah, this time at least we can see the infrastructure is in place, the terminals and all the things are in place. So at least this time, it appears they'll make good their promise.
Are the people in Dar es Salaam excited about this new system?
Yeah, people are excited because public transport in this city, as you know, Dar es Salaam is one of the fastest growing cities, both in terms of population and by size. So it's very chaotic. So, the commuter transport is very chaotic. So people are really excited. They are looking forward to this modern transport.
I see. Dar es Salaam, like other cities in the region, have had a big problem of traffic congestion in the city. And the gap has been filled by motorcycle taxis. In this new arrangement, where those motorcycle taxis fall?
The motorcycles, we call them border borders. The border borders and the tricycles, we call them bajajis here. They are not allowed to get into the CBD. So they'll be operating from the city outskirts. They are not allowed to use this infrastructure. So they'll be operating outside the city center.
We understand some buses have arrived already and they're going to make arrangements to have card readers. So this must be an advanced transit system.
Yeah, sure. This is a new thing, and there has been a campaign to raise awareness for the public and the drivers on how to use them. It's a new thing, so we are eagerly waiting to see how it will operate.
And in your view, this will take care of the traffic congestion problem in Dar es Salaam?
Yeah, but many analysts think will only partly solve the problem. It needs to go hand in hand with the other projects, maybe flyovers, to erect flyovers on intersections, busy intersections, and maybe widening the roads, because Dar es Salaam has some of the narrowest roads. So the coming of this project cannot completely solve the problem. It will only help to minimize congestion, but maybe in 2, 5, 3 years, they'll need to come up with bigger projects now.
Then the new president happens to have an idea on this kind of project. So are people confident that maybe many more good things are going to happen at Dar es Salaam?
Yeah, the good thing, the newly elected minister, Mr. John Magufuli, was formerly minister for works. And he did a good job, because now almost all the main regions in Tanzania are connected with good infrastructure. The roads are passable throughout the year. So people are really excited because Magufuli has proved that he can deliver.
Charabi Barasa is a journalist with the Tanzania newspaper The Daily News. He spoke with reporter Douglas Impuga from Dar es Salaam. Elsewhere, hundreds of delegates from across Africa and around the world met in Cape Town, South Africa recently to discuss youth unemployment and potential opportunities for them in agriculture. The summit attracted senior government officials, business executives, representatives from the private sector, as well as youth delegates. From Cape Town, South Africa, viewers Ruben Chiama reports.
The summit focused on best practices and effective approaches for preparing young people for employment and entrepreneurship opportunities in agriculture. It also encouraged young participants to explore the challenges they face in securing meaningful economic opportunities. Ms. Thelma Namonje, a 30-year-old research associate from the Zambia-based Indaba Agricultural Policy Research Institute, was among those who took part in the summit. She says she believes that this generation can end the global food insecurity if practical strategies and solutions are developed to enable young people in Africa embrace sustainable agriculture.
It's something that the continent has faced for a long time, food insecurity every time. It's a song that we've been singing. And it's time that the young generation take up that as their responsibility to do something if they can actively engage in agriculture.
Speaking to the Voice of America at the close of the summit, Rita Roy, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Mastercard Foundation, said the conference helped to stimulate unique, fresh thinking around ways in which young people can make the transition into employment, especially into agricultural sector.
I think the first thing that has come out of the conference is high energy. That's what I've heard, because we put young people at the center of the work at the summit. And so we saw some very demonstrable examples of how young people are already taking action. We heard from a young entrepreneur who began at the Africa Rabbit Center when she was 14 years old. And we learned that each female rabbit can generate revenue of $1,000 a year.
A recent study conducted over the past 6 months revealed that some 600 million people in Africa are under the age of 25, and 72% of its youth live on less than $2 a day. The findings highlight the extraordinary length that young people go to as they try to find work. Namonje says the lack of access to credit facilities among the youth is a major deterrent.
Most youths don't have capital. You go to a bank, they need collateral. You're only 18 or 20, and you haven't accumulated any assets to use to go and borrow funds and all that. If you can have microfinancing institutions that can help the young people to start up a business, that would be very helpful.
Regarding the foundation's work in Africa, Roy said the Toronto-based organization is working in 28 countries across the continent, where it has committed $1.6 billion. She says its programs are concentrated in three areas.
One is to expand access to financial services for people who are living in poverty. Second is to expand access to education, especially the secondary level and at the higher education level. And third is to bring what we know from financial services and education to really focus on enabling young people who never had the chance to go to school to be able to transition from unemployment or maybe hazardous work to decent work so they can have sustainable livelihoods.
She said the first agricultural sector is critical to the transformation of the continent, both economically and socially.
I just came away from one of the sessions with an organization called Harambe, which is right here in South Africa, very unique model, which is all about understanding where is their demand in the economy. And they showed a very, very in-depth analysis of how they could map 680,000 jobs here in South Africa.
Some of the key topics discussed included agriculture in Africa and its growth prospects, agricultural financial services, and the role of technology. Among the youth speakers at the conference was Hawad Milasi, country project manager for the Opportunities for Youth Employment Program in Tanzania. It's a local youth development initiative supported by the Netherlands NGO SNV in partnership with the Mastercard Foundation.
Speaking of my country, we have about 100,000 young people who are coming out of universities every year. But the labor market cannot take up all these youth. So an option is entrepreneurship.
According to experts, the agricultural sector is set to create 8 million stable jobs by the year 2020 and up to 14 million if governments and entrepreneurs can boost investment. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Versace. You is in Nicki Minaj. That's the life she did fight to karate. Yeah, hey, I bought in a Bugatti. Yeah, hey, I go buy you Ferrari. You don't get any choice but to marry. Yeah, hey, I go give you the khaki. Yeah, hey, you be calling me daddy. Come on to Tampa. Je m'appelle one day cook. Je vais danser avec toi. Pour danser avec moi. Yeah,
I say you like Lukumba.
Oh yeah, that's I'm like a willow Lukumba.
I know say you like Lukumba.
Oh yeah, that's I'm like a willow Lukumba.
In love, cause she got me falling in love. Oh, yeah. In love, cause she got me falling in love. Yeah.
To karate, yeah, hey, I bought in a Bugatti, yeah, hey, I go buy you Ferrari. You don't get any choice but to marry, yeah, hey, I go give you the khaki, yeah, hey, you be calling me daddy.
Carilla, señorita, bonita, mamacita, Aisha, señorita.
My lady, I mean I'm a no rain in us, no fall.
make a baby last, eh, eh. Make me last, eh, oh, eh. A baby last, eh, eh.
Party, eh? Come on, for my party, eh? Kill a party for my party, eh? Eh?
for a party, eh, eh. Holiday for a party, eh, eh. We go go on a holiday, eh. I want to say this a lot. I want your body just to say a lot. But you lose so much. Oh boy, your body, they make me dead. See now you, they make my head, they go Korogo, eh.
Korogo.
And I just, they love your body, so Walango, eh.
Walango.
And my heart and soul is up for you, my baby, eh.
Music from the continent. Hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for our Saturday commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure to share my reflections with the audience of the Voice of America in Africa and beyond. This week, anyone who is looking at U.S. policy towards Africa and is paying attention to African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States must pay close attention to development in Paris, because the United States has been one of the most important allies of France. The relationship between these two countries goes back to the founding of the American Republic, when France suffered from a theater attack from a terrorist group. It has repercussions around the globe because it means terrorism is an open and dangerous threat to civilized life. So when we talk about U.S. policy towards Africa, you now come to a triangular relationship, because France, I have written somewhere in one of these journals that Africa is the great magnifying mirror of France. So whatever affects France has consequences for Africa and implications for Africa. And definitely, America is an important part of the triangle. So when it comes to terrorism, you can see terrorism in France is very much related to terrorism in Africa, and it has implications for America. Since 9/11, the United States has been very much involved in dealing with terrorism. And this is one of the reasons why what happened in France is a very serious development in terms of violence in human society. And this is one of the reasons why when we look at U.S. policy towards Africa, we have to pay close attention to the fundamental issues in Africa's relations with America, or inversely, America's relations with Africa. Let me identify key issues that are affecting us this week. Recently, African leaders met with European leaders with regard to immigration. I have been arguing about immigration, stupid, for the Africans to pay attention. Long before you have these Syrians going in like numbers to Europe, you have a lot of African kids who are dying on the Atlantic. If you go to Senegal and Mali and some of the other areas, which are the starting point for all these African immigrants going to Europe, you have many kind of songs from their musicians. One of our students, who is from Taiwan, went to Senegal and came and wrote a dissertation dealing with this whole phenomenon of migration and how it affects the life of many Senegalese. And of course, by extension, Malians. There are a lot of Malians in France, Guineans, Mauritanians, and all these other African groups. So when you talk about immigration, we now have to pay close attention to the problems of the youth in Africa. When you talk about U.S. relationship with Africa, you have to talk about poverty, backwardness, and underdevelopment. And more dangerous for all of us is not for those European governments to give money to African governments who are still corrupt, taking those money at the expense of young people. Most dangerous for all of us is when these leaders in Africa do not pay attention to development, agriculture, and other areas, and get these young people mobilized instead of allowing them to go to cities and towns in their countries. Let them develop agriculture and invest in the agricultural development of their own society. This is where foreign aid from America makes sense. For the Peace Corps volunteers who used to go and work with Africans, that was a good lesson from the Kennedy period. It's still alive. It's still a good idea. All these young Africans who are migrating to the West in the hope that they are going to make it good here. And ironically, the Chinese are going to their countries, buying their land, and doing what other people in Africa used to do in their villages. This is a very important point for American foreign policy thinkers. If the Americans, the French, and other Europeans are genuinely interested in African development, they have to pay close attention to terrorism and how terrorism can be beautified by being rounded up in metaphysical garments. In the day of secularism and human progress, we have to pay attention to how poor people cannot be dancing around religious narratives in the hope of going to heaven. That has to be addressed, because that is the major problem we have. Because the relationship between peace and security, the relationship between moral consciousness and moral development, which was the story of all the Abrahamic tradition, how human beings can be living with one another in peace, and how they can celebrate their fidelity to a higher being who comes to them at the end of their life. We don't have to have human beings killing each other because they are impoverished or they are angry and they are bitter against other people and use violence. And this should be the message of the leadership in the UN, in the United States here, and most importantly, as an American, I would say our leaders here must pay close attention to poverty and the young people. And that is the message for all the Africans who are listening from their respective countries and hearing a voice from the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the affable John Dryden. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, until the lion learns how to write, every story will glorify the hunter. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, which provides over $95 million to HIV and AIDS funding to Zimbabwe through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, is refocusing its support to areas and populations with the highest burden of disease, a senior U.S. Embassy official in Harare said on October 27th. PEPFAR is committed globally to go where the virus is, targeting interventions for populations at greatest risk in areas of greatest HIV incidence. PEPFAR resources remain substantial at $128.7 million, including an additional funding for DREAMS, an ambitious partnership to reduce HIV infections among adolescent girls and young women, and voluntary medical male circumcision scale-up, but are insufficient to meet the growing demand for treatment and other services, said Robert Scott, Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy. In line with UNAIDS' fast-track strategy, allocation of resources will focus on achieving the greatest impact to reach epidemic control in a short space of time. Scott was speaking at a health policy dialogue session organized by the Southern African Political and Economic Series. The meeting brought together representatives of government, the private sector, development partners, and civil society organizations. Scott said PEPFAR resources will be concentrated in the 36 scale-up districts and 541 sites requiring intensive support and will focus efforts on populations with the highest numbers of new infections and people living with HIV. He said efforts to sustain key care and treatment activities in 53 high-volume sites across the entire country will continue. Target populations, he said, were identified based on the UNAIDS hotspot mapping, demographic health survey, and program data. High-risk and vulnerable populations, including sex workers, adolescent girls and young women, as well as individuals living in mining areas, growth points, and areas with migrant workers, among others. Since 2006, PEPFAR has provided over $650 million to Zimbabwe. As a direct result of this continuous support, by the end of 2014, 160,000 people were on antiretroviral therapy and receiving related HIV services and care. The policy dialogue session was held to facilitate dialogue among stakeholders involved in health services delivery in Zimbabwe and covered a number of key policy issues, including health financing and insurance, coordination, and human resources retention. The U.S. is proud to work with Zimbabwe's health ministry and multilateral organizations in the development and implementation of a health strategy that meets the needs of the people of Zimbabwe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.